so pleased to be of assistance, to be invited to be a part of the town. What do you suggest I do with him then? Don't do anything with him, Bella said. He clearly wants to be left alone. Leave him alone. The guy doesn't want to connect with the people of this town because he doesn't like them. You can't make people like you. How could you not like us? Snail said. We're lovely. Someone's trying to kill you all, Vicky, Bella said. You can't be that nice. Chapter 50. Dez stared at the ceiling. He seemed to be looking for an escape hatch from his daughter's accusations. Let me show you one of our albums, he said. He went to a nearby cabinet and fished out a photo album. I put the book between Snail and me and started flipping through the pictures. Gangly teenagers, all lanky with knobbly knees and big smiles, crouched on rocks before the sheer edge of Last Chance Valley. Some were climbing a huge rock formation in the desert. Some stood pointing towards the horizon. Bright faces, sunburned girls and boys sitting in the light of a fire. What sort of leadership stuff do you do with the kids out there? I asked. Navigation, emergency survival techniques, a bit of endurance and adventure training. Cash had perked up beside me. That sounds awesome, he said. How'd you develop the program? Oh, I'm an old reservist myself. That's great. Cash downed his scotch quickly. I'd love to know what techniques you're using. Do you get them into any self-defense tactics? Well, I would, but I don't have much experience in... Oh, wow. Cash pulled his chair in, sat upright like an obedient German shepherd. I have some great drills for young people, leadership stuff like you're looking for. I got my certification as a recruit trainer a while back. I could definitely assist. The two fell into conversation. Bella appeared in a couple of the photographs, hanging out at the edge of the frame, fiddling with her bag or staring at the fire. She was watching me from across the table, one leg drawn up so that her elbow rested on her knee, pushing food restlessly around her plate. "Did you go on many of the expeditions?" I asked. "A few," she said. "It was usually me behind the camera." Snail looked at an image of Dez leading a bunch of kids through a search and rescue drill, four of them carrying another on a stretcher. Bella seemed the only person not interested in the photos. "So who killed Theo Campbell?" Bella asked idly, with a mouth full of beans. I had to draw myself away from the adventures before me. "You tell me," I said. "I think he was into some tricky stuff," she smiled. "He was starting to get a bit loose with the rules by the time I was ready to leave here for uni last year. Around that time, he caught a bunch of us on the South Ridge hanging out, smoking weed." I looked to Bella's father to see if he'd react to his daughter's admission, but he was busy talking to Cash. "Chief Campbell didn't do anything," Bella continued. "Didn't even take it off us. Just stopped and chatted for a while. I half expected him to ask for a toke. Guess he was getting old. Didn't care anymore." "And who exactly were you up there smoking weed with, young lady?" Snail asked. "You know me, Vicky." Bella tapped the side of her nose. "I'm good with my secrets." Something over my shoulder, through the glass doors to the porch, caught her eye. She leaned sideways, took another spoonful of beans into her mouth. "Better get your guns out, coppers," she said, seeming amused and nodding towards the doors. "There's trouble out there." Chapter 51. The sound of footsteps, followed by thumping at the front door. I'd risen from my chair instinctively and dashed down the hall, my gun stupidly still on the coffee table where I'd left it before dinner. Zack Tabey was leaning against the door, bashing on it with his hands. He all but fell into my arms as I yanked it open. He was drenched in sweat and shaking. "They're after me. They're after me. What the hell's going on? Help! They shot at me. They're trying to kill me." I went out into the night. It was quiet. On the road in the distance, I could see a car stopped, its headlights picking up the evening dust, shifting in the gentle breeze. The occasional fluttering of a locust attracted to its beams. I started down the garden path and out of Dez's front gate. Cash was close behind me, actioning his pistol.
"Who is it?"
"Probably Jace Robert and his merry band of meatheads.
If they fired a shot at that kid, we'll need to bring them all in."
"I'll just talk to them," I said, waving him off. "Stay here. We don't want to present a hostile front." The car remained idle, the engine humming as I approached. I could see there were four men in it. The elbow hanging out the driver's side indeed belonged to the leathery brown body of Jace Robert. He was watching me approach with a small smile playing about his lips. I knew these men. Though they'd used their truck tonight to chase down a frightened teenager, cracking pot shots off over his head to put the fear of God into him, he wasn't their usual quarry. These were the guys who went out chasing, hunting, gutting bush pigs and kangaroos. The bloodthirsty, bored, angry men of small towns who had too much firepower and not enough targets to keep them satisfied. I gained speed as I approached the car, lifted my boot as I got within range, and kicked the mirror off the driver's side door. The mirror and its casing smashed into the road, glass sparkling in the dim light.
"Hey, what the fuck?"
Jace shouldered the door open, jumped down and grabbed my shoulder, fingers going for the underside of my arm in a bruising grip. I gave him a half-strength jab to the face, sending him stumbling back, more surprised than injured.
"I told you to leave that kid alone," I said. "You got hearing problems?"
"And I told you that we handle things ourselves out here," Jace said. The other men were out of the truck now and all around me. Two were behind me, blocking Cash's advance. My partner was on the road, 100 meters back and approaching fast, his gun by his side.
"That kid's a danger to our town." Jace pointed at the house. "We want him out. I don't care what you do with him. Take him back to the fucking city with you. Take him into, what do you call it, protective custody."
"He hasn't done anything wrong." One of the farmers behind me snorted.
"You're not from around here, sweetheart," Jace sneered. "You've got to understand, there are people who belong here and people who don't, and the Tabey kid doesn't belong. In the bush, you have the native animals and you have introduced species." He held one palm up, then another, separate. "Like feral cats. They prey on the natives. If you don't squash them before they multiply, suddenly you'll be overrun."
"Thanks for the environmental science class," I said, truly enlightening. "I have a couple of lessons of my own, you know, but you're not going to enjoy them. So I'm telling you just one last time, get back in that truck and fuck off home before I decide to start teaching." A ripple of surprise went up through the group of men around me. They looked at each other and laughed. None of them backed down.
"Harry,"
Cash was at the edge of the gathering now.
"Don't."
"Don't what?" Jace sniffed, looking me up and down.
"You heard the man, Elliot?"
I said, cracking my knuckles.
"He said they handle things themselves out here."
"So let's handle it."
Chapter 52.
When I fight men, they try to put me on the ground first. They don't want to punch a woman right away. Not until they understand that I'm no ordinary woman. They figure they can grab me and push me into the dirt, and I'll realize that I've been playing big boy games and I need to go back to my dolls and stop fooling myself. Jace Robert was a hard man. Wiry strength from years of working on farms, burning off fat and loading muscle around uncrackable bones.
His big hands came for my shoulders again. I ducked and stepped sideways, gave him a fast uppercut to the ribs, knocking the wind out of him. He stumbled, tried to swing an arm around the back of my neck. I bowed out of it, stepped behind him and kicked him in the ass. A short, involuntary laugh from the men around him, a sudden betrayal. Jace's fury was rising quickly. Big mistake, fighting angry. I was enjoying this. I wanted them all to jump in at once. This was my therapy. I sidestepped Jace as he came for me again, but he saw the move, swung and glanced his knuckles off my ear. I took the pain, lapped it up gratefully. I stepped forwards and faked the left jab, punched him square in the nose with my right. Blood on the dirt. Exhilaration zapped through me at the sight of it. "Steady on!" One of the farmers stepped towards us, having had quite enough of my show. He grabbed me from behind and I kicked Jace in the chest, used the backward momentum to shove me into the second attacker, the two of us barreling into the ground. I rolled right and stepped on his hand and heard a crunch. The man screamed. "Grab her," one of them said. "Fucking grab her, John." "Yeah, John," I beckoned the man with a wave. "Come grab me." The two of them lunged at me at once, hardly fair but not unexpected. They thought I'd back up, so I dove instead for John's legs and felt him tumble over me, his own momentum working against him. John's friend came for me and I kicked up at him from the ground, catching him in the chin. Jace's nose was pouring blood down his face as his friends dragged him to his feet. The men gathered together to reassess the situation. Mentions of a psycho bitch. I wasn't done yet. But when I beckoned the men forwards again, none of them moved. They just stood there, panting, bewildered by the first devastating round. "Come on," I urged. My own fury was starting to rise. No one moved. "Oh, for fuck's sake, you pussies." I watched the men drive off past Dez's house, standing in the dark beside Cash. My partner had surprisingly little to say at first. We walked back down the dusty road together under the stars. I hadn't even exerted myself enough to break a sweat. The punch in the ear had caused a warm, throbbing pain that wasn't entirely unpleasant. I reached up and held it, relished in the hurt. It would bruise. It'd be hard to sleep on it. That was something at least. Cash laughed after a while and I looked up at him. "I thought you said we didn't want to present a hostile front," he said. "That wasn't hostile," I said. "Hostile would have been arresting them on sight. They wanted us to speak their language. I spoke it. I just wish they'd held out longer." He didn't reply. I knew how it sounded. My brother was accused of being one of the most vicious, violent people in the nation's history, and here I was, upset that I hadn't been able to beat a bunch of men into unconsciousness. But the words just came out of me before I could stop them. Cash glanced sideways at me and I caught it, the wary look of someone assessing a threat. The truth was, Cash was right to be wary of me. Most of my life I'd wavered over a very thin line between light and dark sides of my being. There were things in me that were frightening. How quick I was to anger. How much I liked hurting people sometimes. My mind was full of shadowy places where violent fantasies lived, sickening things that sometimes came out in my dreams. Vengeance I played out mentally against bad people from my past. Most of the time, my light half won out, and the shadows and smoke were sent recoiling to where they belonged, not completely driven out, but controlled. But sometimes the halves collided, the score came down 50-50, and everyone was left guessing what I might do. Even me.
Chapter 53. Witt had decided he wasn't comfortable with Tox Barnes at all. A Sydney colleague had warned him that he'd suffer consequences from associating himself with the shaggy, despondent detective. That a deep, hidden sin in Tox's past, a double murder, some said, meant that he was an enemy within the ranks of the police, and that he was to be avoided at all costs. It wasn't just that, though. To be in the man's presence felt hazardous, like a journey along a frozen road at night with rain battering the windscreen. The man spoke little, laughed almost never, and caused people who didn't even know him to shift out of his path. He was stale-smelling and dusty all the time, as though when he went home at night to wherever in the world that might be, he simply tucked himself into an old cupboard and closed the door. Wit's own terrible history had caused him to become almost obsessed with freshness and newness, the cleanliness and orderliness of packaged things. He changed his toothbrush on the first of every month. He littered his sock drawer with moisture absorbers. If things weren't exactly right, they were deeply, inexcusably wrong. Wit was having those familiar nervous palpitations as he approached Tox on the third floor of the University of Sydney West car park.
"I got the CCTV," Wit said, drawing a sheet of paper from the folder tucked under his arm.
He handed Tox a grainy photograph printed from the security system of a hock shop in Bondi Junction. Wit had managed to track down footage of the purchase of the video camera found in Sam Blue's apartment, originally stolen from an apartment in Elizabeth Bay. The still showed a man in a cap exiting the front doors of the store.
"It's not a great picture," Wit said. "No, it's not," Tox sighed. "Could be Sam Blue, could be his grandmother."
"I'm going to get it analysed," Wit said. "See if we can measure the man's dimensions against the angle of the camera in the doorway. He seems taller than Blue to me."
"You talked to the Simpson girl?"
"Yes."
"Convinced?"
Wit struggled. "She maintains everything from her last statement. The white van, the screaming, Caitlin standing there as she ran past."
"We'll soon find out," Tox said.
Wit took a deep breath and looked around at the car park. They walked to the door to the fire stairs. Was this where Caitlin McBeal had taken her last breaths of free air? And if it was, would she ever take any again? Chapter 54. "This is where both girls allegedly entered," Wit said, walking through the fire escape door. He glanced down the stairwell. "I suppose the abductor might have seen Linny coming up the stairs, decided she was his type, thought he'd stand here, wait for her to come through." He walked back through the door and leaned against the wall, made like he was ready to pounce. Linny comes through, he grabs her, drags her that way, over to where that white van is sitting. Wit pointed to a car space 50 meters away, where a white van sat with the side door open. He paused, puzzled at the sight of it sitting there, the very same make and model of vehicle the witness had described in her interviews. Tox had his hands in his pockets. He looked nonchalantly towards the van.
"So what we want to know is," Tox said, "how likely is Linny's story? Why did no one hear her screams and then Caitlin being abducted? Would the attacker have been able to drag Caitlin 50 metres to the van? Where and how might he have left traces of the crime if he did?"
Wit was still puzzled by the van. He looked at Tox. "That's the same kind of van Linny reported seeing at the abduction," Wit said.
Tox nodded. "It's my van. I brought it here for the purposes of our experiment."
"What experiment?" Tox didn't answer. He was watching a woman walking towards them up the slope of the ramp, her enormous spike heels clopping like horseshoes on the asphalt. Wit's first thought was that university students sure dressed differently now to the way they did when he studied. As she got closer, however, Wit began to notice bruises on her slender white legs, climbing all the way to the hem of the tiny miniskirt. The long blonde ponytail was clearly fake, clipped in extensions. She put the phone she'd been texting on away in a small faux fur handbag and smiled broadly at Tox. "Detective Barnes," she said, hardly glancing at Whit. "It's been a long time, honey."
"Sure has."
Tox looked warm and friendly, Whit thought, a sudden transformation of his usually dark being. Something was not right.
"Whit, this is Sandy. Sandy, Whit."
"This is a bit of a weird place for a two-on-one," Sandy smirked uneasily, looking around the car park. "Are we getting out of here, or..."
"Oh, no. We'll play our game right here," Tox said. He checked his watch.
There was a strange, tight pause as the man simply stood there, smiling at the girl's face. Whit opened his mouth to ask what was going on, but before he could, Tox lunged at the girl, grabbing her by both arms, yanking her towards him.
"You're coming with me, girlie," Tox snarled.
"Whoa!" Whit stumbled backwards. "Whoa, whoa!
What are you doing?" Sandy screamed. "What are you doing? Help! Help!"
The girl in Tox's arms suddenly sprang to life, bucking and twisting in his grip. The two of them fell into the side of a parked car. Whit launched himself forwards, trying to wrestle the girl from Tox's grip as he dragged her towards the van. Her screaming was so loud up close that his eardrums pulsed.
"Please, stop! Help me!"
"Stop! Tox! Let her go!" Tox threw his weight sideways, knocking Whit into another car, sending his glasses skidding across the asphalt. Sandy twisted in Tox's arms, bashed at his head with her forearms. He stopped and adjusted his grip, hugged her to him like a child and loped in the direction of the van with her howling against his chest.
"In you go,"
he laughed triumphantly, placing Sandy in the cabin of the van and slamming the door. Sandy was screaming, beating on the door with her fists. Whit limped towards Tox, his lower back aching from slamming into the side mirror of a nearby Toyota.
"What the hell is wrong with you? Let her out of there."
50 seconds,
Tox said, glancing at his watch. He pushed the door of the van open and Sandy got out. She slapped Tox hard across the side of the head.
"You asshole," she panted. "What the fuck is wrong with you?"
"It was just a game, sweetheart."
Tox reached out and took her shoulders in his big, calloused hands, smoothed her arms.
"That's all. No need to get your pretty feathers all ruffled."
"You're crazy,"
Sandy huffed, and tried to assess the damage the struggle had done to her artificial hair.
"You've always been a crazy fuck."
She slapped him again, hard across the face. Tox peeled a couple of hundreds off a roll he produced from his pocket. Sandy snatched the bills and tucked them into her bra, held her hand out for more. Tox sighed and peeled again. Sandy frowned at Whit.
"Great load of help you were," she snapped, jutting her chin at Whit. "Was this your idea? You some kind of freak who likes to watch abductions?"
"No, no," Whit protested. "I really...
What the hell was all that for?"
"I needed a screamer," Tox said. "A real screamer, not someone faking it. We're being scientists today, darling."
Sandy looked unconvinced. A man in a grey uniform was running up the slope towards them, his hand on his belt.
"What's going on?"
He wiped at a sweaty head of black hair. "Who's in trouble?"
"You are," Tox said.
Chapter 55.
"I'm Detective Inspector Tate Barnes, and this is Detective Inspector Edward Whittaker."
Tox paused when he got to Sandy. "And this is our associate. We're investigating the abduction of Caitlin McBeal."
"Oh,"
the man said. He brushed at the front of his grey uniform, fiddled with a name badge that read, "Bill Perkins, Security."
"William Perkins, you're the security guard who gave police a statement about that day, aren't you?"
Tox folded his arms.
"Yes."
Interesting. Tox glanced at the sunshine streaming in through the side of the lot. Same day of the week, same hour of the day that Caitlin was apparently abducted. Wind direction seems to be more or less the same. You hear the screams of a woman, screams that last 50 seconds, and you come running. Yes. Bill shifted uncomfortably. You were down there in your little security guard's hut on the first floor just now, were you?
Uh-huh.
Bill cleared his throat. That's where you said you were at the time of Caitlin's alleged abduction?
Yep.
So, all the variables are the same as they were on that day, but you said in your statement that you didn't hear any screams, Tox said. You said you heard no screams, no scuffle on the third floor. You said you didn't see a white van exit the driveway anywhere around that time. The security guard looked intently at Sandy. She was the safe place to look. Wit and Tox's eyes bored into the man's face, assessing every muscle twitch.
Were you where you were supposed to be on that day, Mr. Perkins?
Yes, Bill straightened. I was.
Really? Wit raised an eyebrow.
Yes.
What if, for example, Tox mused, what if I took your head, Bill Perkins, and I put it in the gap of the sliding door of my van here, he gestured to the van, and I slammed the door closed over and over.
Bill swallowed, looked at Wit for help. There was none.
Would your answer still be the same? Tox asked.
Bill started to back up, then turned and ran.
Answer the question, Tox called.
The security guard put his head down and ran for his life. Tox sighed, pulled a packet of cigarettes from his pocket and lit one.
He wasn't in the guard hut that day. I don't know where he was, but he wasn't there.
Chapter 56. After Sandy left them, the two men walked to the edge of the car park and leaned on the concrete wall, Tox smoking, Wit trying to contain his inner horror at his partner's experiment. They looked over the edge and across a wide, empty netball court to a narrow green lawn where students were filming interviews with handycams, sitting on wooden benches, now and then glancing at written notes as they narrated their works.
Maybe Bill, the security idiot, was in the bathroom, Tox mused. Maybe he has a girlfriend on campus he was visiting. Maybe he was listening to music. Whatever the case, it's possible Linny Simpson was telling the truth. Someone did try to abduct her, and she screamed her head off, and no one heard her.
Wit didn't know if that made him feel better or worse.
But the van doesn't make any sense, Wit reminded him. No white van came or went during the times Caitlin would have been taken.
Where is she? Tox growled. If we could just find her, this would all make sense.
The two men watched the people on the lawn below them.
What are these chumps up to? Tox wondered aloud.
Wit looked across the lot at the young people with their cameras.
Film class, looks like. Maybe they have some footage from that day.
Tox blew smoke into the wind.
They'd have heard the screaming, though, Wit said, wouldn't they?
Nah, not with those headphones on, Tox said.
Wit followed nervously as Tox descended the concrete stairs to the little garden. The students stopped their filming and assessed Tox as he arrived among them. Four of them were gathered around a single camera, thick headphones clamped to their heads. They took down the headphones.
Sup?
Tox jutted his chin at the leader of the group, a lanky late teenager with a shaving rash and long, greasy dreadlocks.
Nothing much, the boy answered. What's this?
Tox gestured to the group, the cameras.
film assignment. Been doing it long? A few months. It's our major assessment task. It's due next week. Tox rocked on his heels. Let me look at it. What? I want to look at it. Why? Because I said so. Tox shrugged. The gentle, menacing shrug of a dangerous man. Let me look at it. Wit cleared his throat. He understood why Tox was being mysterious with the youths. If there was footage relevant to the abduction of Caitlin McBeal, Tox and Wit would need to confiscate it, and that would take a warrant, and a warrant would take time. A search of the students' footage was technically illegal. Wit didn't like all the muscling Tox was doing, but he couldn't bring himself to stop what was about to happen. His personal and professional ethics were slowly, slowly degrading.
We don't have to show you anything, the dreadlocked boy said.
Tox didn't reply. He reached out and grabbed the nearest handycam, plucking it from the grip of a young woman with green hair. He stood in the sun and started pushing buttons on the screen, flipping through dates on the digital files. The students exchanged glances, wide-eyed. Wit held his hand out apologetically to another handycam holder. The young man gave a confused glance to their leader and then handed over the camera.
Who are these guys?
Someone whispered.
Should we call someone?
What's this all about? One of the girls asked Wit.
We've got permits. We're not doing anything wrong.
We'll just be a minute, Wit said gently. I'm really sorry.
Any footage of drug taking on those cameras is strictly staged, one of the young people said, eyes on the sky. We're making a public awareness film.
Got it.
Tox showed Wit his camcorder screen. 10 July, 3 p.m. The two men huddled together, watching the student's interview on the tiny screen. The camera faced the car park exit, the driveway at the corner of the image. Anticipation churned in Wit's chest. Tox fast-forwarded the footage. The girl on the screen twisted and shivered, her mouth jabbering silently. She was wearing headphones too, doing a sound check. A dark green sedan exited the car park. The footage ended. The two men exhaled. The students around them seemed to sense that whatever they were looking for was not on their footage. Tox handed the tiny camera back to the girl he'd taken it from.
Thanks, guys, Wit smiled.
They turned and started wandering away, but after only a few steps he stopped. There was a zinging feeling creeping up from his fingertips, a flush of heat in his throat that even he didn't know the cause of at first. Suddenly, he realized. It all fell into place. He gripped his partner's arm.
Chapter 57
What? Tox grunted.
Wit's mind was rushing. He struggled to form words.
What?
Tox repeated. How do we know it was a white van? Wit asked.
Linny Simpson said the guy tried to drag her into a white van.
But has anyone else ever said that? Has there ever been a white van connected with the other missing girls?
Well, Tox thought about it. No.
It's always a white van, isn't it? Wit's heart was beginning to race in his chest. In the movies, people are always abducted into black or white vans. What if Linny Simpson was right about everything that happened to her except the vehicle?
Wit closed his eyes, remembered Linny sitting before him at the cafe table.
She said the van door was closed. He looked at Tox. When the abductor, dragged her over to the van, he didn't manage to get her into the back of the vehicle. It was closed. That doesn't make sense.
Why not?
He'd have left it open. Surely he didn't plan to grab her, drag her all the way over to the van, drop her on the ground, and expect her to lie there while he pulled the door open.
How sure was she that the van door was closed? Tox asked.
She took a blow to the head. She fainted afterwards. That's one of the main reasons the police rejected her story, because they think she was confused. Whit shrugged helplessly. Tox considered Whit's words. Then he walked back to the group of students and plucked up the camera again.
"Hey, we need that," one of the girls cried. "It's due next week."
"It's worth a shot," Tox said. "Let's get a bolo on the green sedan, see what turns up." Whit was rubbing the bridge of his nose as they ascended the fire stairs, a headache pulsing behind his eyes. "Oh, shit," he said. "My glasses." He jogged up the stairs, remembering the clatter of his glasses as Tox knocked him sideways in the struggle for Sandy. He searched between the cars, bent low and looked under greasy tyres. He spotted them deep under a blue Camry. Before he could get down, Tox put a hand on his chest. "Not in that fancy outfit." Whit watched as Tox crawled under the car, dragging himself forwards on his belly on the asphalt. He seemed to linger under the vehicle a little too long, the legs of his filthy jeans unmoving. "You all right under there?" Tox scrambled out from under the car, threw the glasses at Whit's chest. He jogged around the back of the Camry, head low and eyes narrowed, like a hound. "What is it?" "This channel," Tox said. "This drainage channel." He pointed to a narrow drainage channel cut into the asphalt, covered with a blackened and oil-covered grill. Tox all but dove under a car two down from where they had stood. Whit heard the scrape of iron. Tox reappeared, grinning triumphantly, smeared with grease, and holding a broken phone. Chapter 58. It was time to go. Time to risk it all. Caitlin had tried to bargain with her captor. She'd tried to reason with him. Hell, she'd even tried sympathizing with him, attempting to understand the kind of sickness a mind like his must have. She understood that she had become an animal to him, an inconvenient pet. He didn't speak to her. His eyes hardly ever found hers anymore. He was beginning to feed her only every second day. It was clear to Caitlin that her captor didn't know what to do with her now. She wouldn't survive waiting for him to decide. This was it. She would have to put everything on the line. Fight or die. Fighting meant lying as still as she could on her belly in the middle of the floor, the wine bottles smashed all around her. The sour, eggy smell of expired alcohol was making her eyes water. She lay for hours before she heard the footsteps in the corridor, hesitant, soft. She heard him shifting back the things he used to block the doorway, the scrape and thump of the biggest thing, the rattling and jangling of the smaller things, his hands on the locks. Caitlin closed her eyes and eased a long breath into her aching lungs, let it slip through her lips. "Softly, softly," she thought. If she screwed this up, it was all over. She felt no fear. One way or another, it was about to be over. Chapter 59. I sat up in my fold-out bed on the snail's porch, listening to the sounds of the night birds and clicking away at my laptop. I was sending inquiries about Sam's case. Whit had emailed a list of leads that he and Tox were working on. A green sedan, a broken phone. The fight with Jace Roberts' people and the optimistic tone of Whit's email had lit a fire in me. Earlier, I'd managed to get a 15-minute phone conversation with Sam, and my brother sounded healthy and calm despite the catcalls in the background. I sent a request to my chief, Pops, to have the security guard from the car park re-interviewed by Nigel's team. I wanted to get in touch with the detectives in the Gold Coast, chasing down sightings of Caitlin McBeal, to find out if there was any truth to the rumours. From a thin mattress on the floor beside my bed, Zach Taibbi spoke up, breaking my concentration.
"So you work on the town's case all day, and you work on your brother's case all night,"
he said. Uh-huh. When do you sleep?
Sleep is for losers.
True.
The Taibbi parents had been mortified first that their son had escaped lockdown at their house, then that he'd been chased like a dog by people from the town. They had been happy to turn him over to us. If my typing is keeping you awake, you're welcome to move your mattress away from mine, I told the boy. No one invited you to sleep this close to me. Frankly, it's weird.
No way, man, the boy said. I'm sticking next to you. You're my guard dog now. You whopped some freaking ass out there. I'm not leaving your side for nothing.
I didn't know whether to feel flattered or annoyed by my description as a guard dog. It had a certain truth to it. I'd have liked to be a guard dog, unthinking, unquestioning, a loyal hound who followed someone I loved at all hours of the day, searching for threats and receiving treats in return for my service. It seemed a blessedly uncomplicated life. I heard a grunting, snuffling sound, and Jerry the pig appeared in the doorway to the living room. The huge animal tested the air with its snout a few times as Zack and I watched. Then it lumbered with effort down the single stair onto the porch and took up residence by the teenager's side, crashing to the ground, a mountain of hairy flesh falling. It seemed the coolest place to sleep that night was by my side.
"How much did you say all that gold was worth?" Zack asked, his chin resting on his hands on the pillow.
The boy had found the rocks on Snail's kitchen table and marvelled at our explanation for them, his mouth hanging open and eyes wide. He'd watched us stash them away behind a handful of books in Snail's living room cabinets.
"About 80,000 bucks, I think." "We could just, like, take it."
His voice was low, conspiratorial.
"What?
Why not?" He rolled onto his side.
"You and me, we could split it. Get the fuck out of this lame-ass town."
I laughed aloud. "That's a nice fantasy you've got there, but $40,000 isn't a lot of money." My words faltered. I was wrong. To some people, it was a lot of money. It was enough for my mother to sell out her only son to the press, to endanger his life, possibly contribute to his internal damnation, at least in the eyes of the public. It wasn't the kind of money you could run away forever on, though. Or was it? What kind of plans did this young man have? How far was far enough from his miserable life in this loveless town?
"If we stayed together, though, it'd be 80, he mused, a smile playing about his lips.
"All right, I smirked. "I see. You and me. A dusty old convertible, running away across the country together, staying in dodgy hotels, escaping our problems in each other's arms."
"Hell yes."
"Please," I sighed. "I'm old enough to be a mother."
"Isn't that kind of hot, though?"
I slid a leg out from under the blanket and kicked him in the side.
"Shut up, idiot boy."
Chapter 60. The boy fell asleep quickly, undisturbed by the pig snores. I lay on my side in the dark, eyes open, staring at the wall. Soon enough, I sighed and picked up my phone, sent a text. "If you refuse the magazine interview, I'll pay you $50,000, I wrote. "I can't let you sabotage Sam's defense." I waited. In time, the phone vibrated in my hands and the screen lit my face. "How soon can you get it?" my mother asked. "I'll transfer it tomorrow," I wrote. "I'd prefer it in cash," she replied.
"I'll bet," I thought.
Chapter 61. I didn't know I'd fallen asleep until the sound came. a wailing, blaring siren that rang in my skull. I shot up and shoved the laptop and phone aside, almost stumbled over the pig on the ground next to Zach's empty mattress. Cash's bare feet thudded on the polished boards of the living room as he rushed out from the front of the house in only boxer shorts, struggling with his glasses. Lights flickered on.
"What is it?"
"A car horn." He was actioning his pistol.
"Where's Zach?" "What's happening?"
Snail ran out of the bedroom in pink pajamas covered in smiling, dancing pigs. I sprinted through the house and out the front door, my partners in tow. Zach was sitting in the driver's seat of Snail's four-wheel drive, leaning on the horn, flashing the high beams. His huge eyes followed me, front teeth locked together.
"What is it?"
I called.
"What? What?"
I reached for the driver's side door beside him, but he screamed before I could pull the handle.
"Don't!"
he cried through the glass, hands flat, palms out, surrendered.
"Don't touch anything! Look! Look!"
He grabbed a sheet of paper from where it had been stuck with tape to the steering wheel. He pressed the paper against the glass. The words were handwritten. They read, "Don't get out." Chapter 62. They sat in Witt's car on the edge of Parramatta Road, the hammering of rain on the roof the only sound they could hear. Though the engine was off, Tox's hard hands gripped the steering wheel. His head was bent forwards and his jaw set, his eyes focused on the patterns the rain made on the windscreen. Witt watched him. He could hardly see the man breathing. His own heart hadn't stopped pounding since they'd stood in the little park inside the university. With the camera in his hands, the sound off, he sat watching the green sedan emerge from the car park driveway at the edge of the footage. There was only a shadow behind the wheel. A pair of white hands pulled the steering wheel sideways, calmly, turning the vehicle left towards the science district.
"It could be nothing," Witt warned.
"When the lab traces the phone's serial number, they might find it just belongs to some other student, someone who dumped it there on purpose or dropped it as they were getting out of their car."
"It's Caitlin McBeal's phone," Tox insisted. "It's broken because she broke it in the struggle as she was being abducted."
Witt sighed. "The green sedan," he continued. "It might just be a student leaving for the day."
"It's the killer," Tox said, "leaving with Caitlin McBeal."
A search on the green sedan's registration had found it was stolen. Witt told himself that didn't mean anything. Students could drive stolen cars, buy them, sell them, steal them, trade them. Students and old cars had a checkered relationship. It could just have been a coincidence that the sedan was leaving the lot mere moments after Caitlin was allegedly abducted. As much as he tried to tell himself they were probably onto nothing, Witt couldn't help but feel a flutter inside him that maybe that was wrong. When Tox's phone chimed, the two men grabbed for it at the same time.
"They've got the car," Witt said, motioning for his partner to start the engine. "It's outside the old Pinkerton Hotel. Let's go."
Chapter 63. Caitlin heard his footsteps nearer, shuffling, despondent, probably relieved that she'd finally expired quietly and without mess. He'd won. His game hadn't been a fast, violent, painful end for her, but a drawn-out one, one in which she would have had to actually give up, cell by biological cell, and let death take her. Now he had her remains to leave here or dispose of as he pleased. His foot against her shoulder, shoving experimentally, once, and then again. She was limp. It wasn't hard to relax her limbs completely. Just to stay awake was an effort, had been for weeks. She let the darkness take her, little by little. She heard him groan as he crouched.
"Yes," Caitlin thought, "a little closer now."
Hidden between her chest and the ground, Caitlin clutched the chunky hexagonal fixture at the end of the long, thin steel rod she had extracted from one of the old beer kegs. The weapon was blunt, rusty, but it was all she had. She balled her fist around the handle as she felt his breath on the back of her neck. Chapter 64. "Oh, my God," I stammered, reading the note in Zach's hand. He pointed desperately to the back seat. I stepped sideways and looked in. There were three huge propane gas bottles sitting like round white passengers strapped into the seat belts. I put my hands on glass, and Zach put his on the other side, staring into my eyes, terror making his whole body shake. "I didn't see the note until I got into the car," he screamed. "I didn't see the gas bottles." "I know," I shouted. "I know. It's okay. It's okay." I looked to my partners. Snail was standing well back, her hands over her mouth. Cash was circling the car, looking in the windows. He dropped to the ground in front of the engine and examined the underside of the car. Both were panting like me, the adrenaline rushing so fast through my veins I could hardly think. My mind split into fragments, thoughts racing in different directions. Three or four times the ludicrous impulse jabbed at me to just open the door and pull the kid out. "Don't panic," I called, unable to keep the fear out of my own voice. My mind was begging me now to get away from the car. There was no telling when it would explode, what might cause it to go off. I stopped touching the windows. Just don't panic. I looked at Cash, and the expression on his face didn't settle me. The back of his hand was against his mouth like he might be sick. He came to the driver's window, his steps shaky, uneven. "What happened when you got in?" he shouted. "I heard a click when I sat down," Zach called, his voice muffled by the glass. "Like a sound like things snapping into place." "Can you hear anything now? Like a ticking or a whirring? Anything?" "I don't know. I'm scared. Don't leave me here, please." The boy burst into tears. On the front passenger seat beside him, I could see the black plastic and duct tape package. He tried to sneak out with the gold, tried to take off into the glorious sunrise, a ridiculous bid for a new life that could cost him his current one. I backed up a couple of steps with Cash, my hands gripping my hair. "What is it?" "It could be a number of things." He licked his sweaty upper lip. "We know from the bomb on the hillside that the killer's new at this, so I'm leaning away from complex chemical reaction devices. It's probably a circuit breaker, mercury tilt switch maybe." What the fuck? How do we disarm it?" "I need to know more about it," he said. The big man before me was trembling gently all over, but his face was hard with focus. "It might be connected to the seat. It might be connected to the doors." "How much time do we have?" "There's no telling. We need to find out if there's a timer and what kind." "You figure that out," I said. "I'm going to do a quick lap around the immediate area. This is a spectacle. There's no way the killer would miss this." I dashed towards the house, wincing as I heard Zach call out after me. "Don't leave me," he screamed. "I don't want to die." Chapter 65. Caitlin rolled, using the momentum to push herself up, her shoulder, arm, hand shooting upwards, the metal rod flashing out. There was less resistance than she anticipated. The end of the rod went straight into his eye socket, seemed to shudder as it cleaved through bone and came to rest in his brain. She got up and staggered back as the man groaned and flopped away from her, limp as a fish. He lay there on his back, the rod sticking grotesquely from his head, bloodless, his mouth agape. Caitlin shivered, her eyes darting over his ragged clothes and filthy boots, the long thin tendrils of grey and brown hair running from the sides of his otherwise bald scalp. A homeless man, one of the people who must have come into the hotel and left the trash she'd seen in the hall. She could hear that it was raining hard, now that the door to her prison room was open. She stumbled, trying not to gag, her stomach rebelling against the sensation now cemented in her memory of the rod going up, the breath coming out of her victim. Fighting her revulsion, there was a white-hot excitement pulsing through her at the sight of the dark, gaping doorway. She could feel sobs pushing their way up her throat, but couldn't hear them. Her ears were ringing. It seemed an age before her hand finally reached the doorframe, and she looked down the long hall. He was there, eyes fixed on the unlocked door, flicking now to her face. Caitlin's captor marched towards her. Chapter 66. I didn't want to leave Zack, but I knew if I could find the killer, I could force him to tell us how to disarm the bomb. My teeth were gritted as I bolted into the house and grabbed my gun, Snail running after me with the diary from the kitchen table. The rage rippling up through my throat was almost a growl. I was going to find this sick fuck and make him reverse the trap he'd put the child in. If I had to beat him to within an inch of his life to make that happen, I would do it. I ran across Snail's porch and through the back door into the yard, keeping low so that my silhouette didn't appear against the light of the house. My gun drawn, I did a sweep, squinting in the dark, then hopped over a fence into the next property. I could still hear Zack's crying from the windswept fields. Around Snail's property, lights were coming on. As the seconds passed, more lights appeared in the distance, as residents called each other, panicked, in the night. "Come on, you fuck," I seethed. "Where are you?" I rushed across the road and through the property opposite Snail's, making for the tiny house in the center of the barren field. As I leapt up onto the porch, a woman emerged, a young mother, small children trailing behind her. She screamed at the sight of me. "I'm police," I said. "Are you all right? Have you seen anyone in the area?" "No, no." The woman tried to usher her kids back through the screen door, but they resisted, mouths gaping at my gun. "We heard screaming. What's happening?" "Get inside," I said. "Shut the door." "It's all going to come out." She shook her head ruefully, trembling before me, her hands gripping the small children by the shoulders of their pajama shirts like they might run off at any second. "It's all coming to an end." "What?" I squinted at her. "What's that mean?" She disappeared inside the house. I kept moving, doing a lap of her house, the next field, sweat sliding down my neck and ribs. When I got back to Snail's house, she was on her knees in the light of the doorway, flipping through the diary as Cash tried to get sense out of Zack. "Did you find anyone?" "No." I knelt beside Snail. "What did you find?" "I think it's this." She pointed to a messy diagram in blue and red ink. "I think it's connected to the seat. If he gets up, it'll blow." I grabbed the diary and took it to Cash, who was standing on his toes with another torch, trying to see down the back of Zack's seat. "Oh, Jesus," Zack panted, his sweat-drenched hands squeaking on the other side of the glass, fingers spread, desperate. "Jesus Christ, I think I can hear ticking." Cash snatched the diary out of my hands, glanced at the diagram. "Thought so. Circuit breaker. It's linked to the driver's seat. We can open the doors."
"Don't open the doors," Zack cried. "I don't want to die. Oh, God, please."
"Let's go with the front passenger side," Cash said, "just in case." We ran to the other side of the car. Cash pushed me back. "I'll do it." He eased the handle of the passenger door out. There was a click. My mouth was dry as I cringed, waiting for the blast. There was none. I rushed forwards to the doorway beside Cash, reached out and grabbed Zack's hands. "It's okay," I squeezed his hot fingers. "Don't move. We're going to figure this out." Cash leaned in the doorway, trying not to touch anything, and shone the light quickly around the seats, the console, the back of the cabin. "Christ," he breathed. "It's all wired up under the seats. I can't get to it from this angle." He stood back, kept his voice low. "I can hear a timer ticking." "Can you see it?"
No, it's tucked up underneath. All the wires are. I can't get at it unless I put my hand in there, and we have no idea where the switch is. If I disrupt the connection at the wrong point, the thing will blow.